Earlier this year on so-called Liberation Day, President Trump put a huge amount of tariffs up to eventually 145% on China because we were getting ripped off, he said, and there was unfair trading practices between the two, and he was going to set it right. That set in motion a series of trade war issues with China, which continues to rage to this day. And where is all this going to go, and how is it going to end up in a good place for the United States? Because there are some challenging issues that even the president himself admitted on television this morning. To try and make some sense out of this, we have back with us for the first time in a while, Lyle Goldstein, my colleague at Defense Priorities, who is a 20-year, before he came with us, he was a 20-year vet, is a professor at the U.S. Naval War College, and is currently the director of Asia Engagement at Defense Priorities. Lyle, welcome back to the show.
Really glad to be here, Danny. You know I'm a big fan.
Well, and I appreciate that a lot, and I appreciate the fact that I'm a big fan of yours, too, and it wasn't too long ago, just a couple of months back, I think, that you invited me up to Brown University to participate in some of the stuff you got going on up there and really valued that experience. That was really cool, so hopefully you can do that again one of these days, by the way. Really good. Well, listen, let's just jump right into this because, Trump a couple of days ago, kind of in a fit of anger, said, I'm going to throw another 100% tariff on top of China because of some of the things that they'd been doing, and that he was really unhappy about that. Well, this morning on Fox Business News, Maria Bartiromo asked the president, and to her credit, she didn't throw any softballs up there. She popped a fastball right down the inside part of the plate and asked him.
I don't know what's going to happen. I can't tell you. We're going to meet in a couple of weeks. We're going to meet in South Korea, actually, with the President Xi and other people, too. But we're going to meet. We have a separate meeting set up.
If you put that 100% tariff on top of what's in place already, you're talking about 157% tariff on China. Can that stand?
No,
what is that going to do to the economy?
It's not sustainable, but that's what the number is. It's probably not, it could stand, but they forced me to do that.
Yeah, it might not really work, but it could stand. But I don't know. I mean, what do you make of that, by the way? We're going to just talk about that issue right there, this slapping 100% tariffs now, 157. Is it sustainable?
No, I think that it's the president was very candid in his response. He made it clear, as is often the case, I think, with President Trump, that he's he will say what he's really thinking, so here that was quite a remarkable admission. I'm glad that he, fully understands that. To me, it's quite clear this is part of a bargaining situation within an escalation spiral, which is really troubling. I mean, you're a national security expert, as am I, and when we see this on the economic side, of course, we think, "Oh, wow, this could happen with dangerous weaponry as well." So that's, we're all worried about this. I think, just even watching the stock market, and I think, today everybody is a bit reassured that we're unlikely to go off this cliff. But this is, Danny, it's very troubling. From what I've seen over the last week. And, I will say, I think for many China experts, this is a bit of a surprise. We didn't, I think many of us considered that the relationship was, almost going better than we thought. And so this this week has been a major setback, resetting, if you will, our expectations. I had high hopes for the meeting coming up at the end of the month. I think we'll talk about that, but I think now I'll just be happy at this point if they shake hands and don't grimace.
Well, that, I hope that doesn't have any market ramifications as well. Let's talk a little bit about how we even got here, and let's kind of start off on Liberation Day, because I think for many people who are watching, I don't know where you fall in this range here, but many people didn't really expect that Trump was going to go in really heavy with this big tariff on China. Apparently, they knew some tariffs were coming, but I think it caught a lot of people by surprise how big the tariffs were on China, even though Trump had always said we're getting ripped off and all this stuff, really for decades, even before he began running for president, so it wasn't a shock. But were you surprised at the number going back to Liberation Day?
I was not surprised. If we go back to the first Trump administration, which was very tough on China, I think, unfortunately, I have to say, appraising the work of the first Trump administration, I think that put us really on the wrong track in terms of U.S.-China relations, and that included on the economic side. Let's remember, I mean, if we were to pick a date when the U.S. trade war and real frictions began, I would go back to sort of, I think, 2020 timeframe when we, more or less outlawed the major Chinese company Huawei and said we don't want to have anything to do with it. So anyway, I wasn't terribly surprised back in the spring. This was kind of, I've met Peter Navarro. I'm familiar with his shtick. I have to say, I think he's really wrongheaded when it comes to China. But seeing that I was happy that a lot of China hawks did not make it into the second Trump administration. I'm talking about, Mike Pompeo, Pottinger, and all that crowd. But unfortunately, Navarro has been instrumental, and I think he's been pushing this tariff line. And of course, China was going to be, at the top of the list or near it anyway. But we all know what happened there.
Right. So that ended up in, it ramped up to initially or ultimately 145% tariffs on the United States, just tit for tat going back and forth. China capped out at 125%. And I think everybody recognized, okay, that's not going to work. You can't be sustaining that on either side of the equation. So then they came back down into a so-called truce in the May timeframe where it came down to about a 30% and then on China. And then we said, all right, well, let's do some negotiations and figure this out. So at the time in May, now when we got back to this so-called truce, did you have some hopes that it would then settle into some kind of normalcy that both could live with?
Yes. I mean, we've seen this, I think, several times in the Trump administration and others too, but I mean, a kind of a shock to the system, you and I are both realists, reality bites. When reality bites, and I think the president and his advisors became acquainted with just how tied up the two economies are, how if we take China down, we will go down with China. Once they, come to that understanding, and so many business leaders complaining, I think it was only logical that the U.S. would pull back from there. Now, look, we have many legitimate gripes with Chinese trade practices. We can talk about those, and we should. But to me, the overall picture is one where we're, mutually dependent. So we have to, the interdependence is there. It's a normal thing between major countries, between two superpowers. And it's actually, I think, certainly from the international security perspective, it's quite a good thing. It means...
Now, let me ask you this. One of the central complaints that Trump has always had is that we're getting ripped off and it's unfair trading practices because of the trade imbalance that certainly favors China, et cetera. But there is a school of thought that said that's not just by virtue of its existence, this trade imbalance, a bad thing for the United States, because there is pros and cons to it on both sides. And some argue that it kind of worked for us and it was okay if it was that way. It's not like a big time negative that somehow if those things had come into equilibrium, that would automatically be better for the United States. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I guess I take kind of a middle position, which is that there are some things probably that are really wrong with the trading relationship. I think the exchange rates for a very long time have been messed up. That is, they create, the renminbi, the Chinese currency or the Chinese yuan is really undervalued all on world markets. And China enjoys, major trade advantages by being able to sell so cheaply across the world. I'm kind of shocked that this doesn't come up more. To my estimate, there should be a revaluation of the renminbi, and that would have major positive consequences for everyone, including China, but particularly it would help to rebalance the trading relationship. So there, I think, And you know, look, China doesn't allow labor unions. So, you know, that does raise some major questions about fairness. And I think these should be argued about at the WTO. So look, there are major problems. On the other hand, look, we can say that the United States and Americans in particular, while yes, they have many legit complaints here, but they have also benefited hugely. You know, we all spend a lot of time at Walmart, and we have for the last 30 years, and there's a reason for that. It's full of cheap Chinese stuff that has made our living standards higher. So we have both benefited, but also clearly some American communities have taken it on the chin, and we need to rethink, you know, certain issues going on in various industries. But look, American manufacturing continues to be highly valued in China. I know Boeing has been in bad straits, I think, of the last few years, but, you know, fly around China on Boeing planes, and Boeing has done extraordinary things in China. So if we, you know, take a kind of win-win approach to the two economies, I think we'll see that we just, you know, you don't got to like China, and there's a lot that's wrong with China, but we do have to find a way forward to get along with them. And I didn't mention American farmers, but American farmers have hugely benefited from the China market, and they are really suffering now. I heard one commentator called it Farmageddon. Think about that, Farmageddon.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of problems in the farming industry, and this Argentina stuff is kind of playing into some of that, but we'll get into that at another time. So this truce happened in May. We were trying to negotiate a final deal, and then according to the Trump administration, China then upended all that on, I think it was the 9th of October, with these export controls that they threw on. And this article here in the New York Times talked about some of the significance of that. They said that the China government announced on Thursday that it was escalating its curbs on exports of rare earth metals. The rare earth rules could scramble the supply chains of some of the world's biggest companies, including NVIDIA and Apple. Rare earths are essential for the production of many computer chips, which are used in everything from smartphones to artificial intelligence systems. Rare earths are also used to make the magnets that produce the electric motors in drones, factory robots, and actually also you can even add in some military aspects for some of our high-tech stuff, like some of our fighter jets or so. What do you make of what caused this? Why did China do this? And how significant is this that they're putting curbs on rare earths for us?
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, it's extremely significant. And by the way, you mentioned how some of these rare earths go into the U.S. defense industry. I think that's exactly right. And you mentioned fighter aircraft. Yes. The part of the armed forces that I tend to focus on, having worked for the Navy for 20 years, I'm very concerned our submarine production could experience problems as a result of this, because apparently, Virginia class submarine that we're building uses a lot of these. So there seems to be a high reliance. And it is notable that in the Chinese restrictions, they said specifically that they are not going to allow the sale of Chinese rare earths into foreign defense production. So, you know, they seem to mean, you know, that they are overtly, you know, if you will, targeting our defense industry, which, you know, has a lot of people riled up on our side. Okay, to your question, which is really the question of the day, certainly among China experts are really scratching their head on this, and I've heard some debate, but I'm working on kind of three theories here. I think one would just looks immediately at what has been going on in September, and said that there were some new restrictions that came down on the American side, as far as like new restrictions on American companies exporting to China. So that's one theory. And I think the Chinese have said that was the main trigger. However, I'm a bit dubious about that, partly because I think that it's clear to me the scale of the restrictions planned on the Chinese side as far as controlling rare earths. It seems to me a very ambitious, large-scale effort that will impact not just the United States, but countries all around the world. And that makes me think that this has been in train for some time. Mm. Now, if we look to the longer term I'm looking at two triggers, really. Well, one, and this kid, there was a great New York Times piece that was in the paper today on October 17. The title was, "With Mineral Clampdown, China Seeks to Beat U.S. at Its Own Game." Think about that, beating U.S. at its own game. And this is the first real admission I've seen in the mainstream U.S. media that basically China is doing back to us what we've been doing to China for the last 5 years. You know, what comes around goes around, Danny. And I please take a look at this article, because it really lays out how that not only is China trying to, put those very same restrictions that we've used, but to the letter. They have literally copied the regulations and the manner in which they're rolling these out. It really suggests they studied our behavior and are mimicking it. And that's very troubling. And it, you know, I do think it should cause some head scratching. As a specialist on U.S.-China relations, I say, we're looking for equality. We're looking for two great powers, two superpowers, to have an equal relationship, not one wagging its finger at the other one.
Yeah.
So that equal relationship, requires that we realize that we cannot coerce China in the way.
So what is the gist of that? What is it that we have done that they're now doing back to us?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I mentioned this all started back in 2020 with Huawei, right? And we said, we're worried about this company. They seem to be infiltrating all of our IT networks. We don't want to have anything to do with them. But then we even took it a step. It's one thing to say, well, okay, no Huawei in U.S. government networks. Okay, that's completely reasonable. And I don't think anybody would oppose that. Even the Chinese would say, fine. But then we took a step further, said we don't want Huawei to operate in the United States, period. Well, that's if not declaring war in a trade war, that's pretty close. But then, Danny, we took it a step beyond that and said none of our allies can work with Huawei, and we don't want to, we don't want to work with countries that work with Huawei. And that, to me, that it's that kind of bullying behavior that not only trying to ruin Chinese companies, but are trying to ruin their whole worldwide market. Yeah. And then, of course, it went a step beyond that, where like this whole thing with chip restrictions. But Danny, I did, if you get one more second here, there is another theory here, which is my sort of primary operating theory on why this happened. And I think it has to do with shipping myself, because the timing looks exactly right. Look, I think China was willing to swallow a lot of the chips restrictions. I mean, you remember the CHIPS Act and all these kind of things going on with chips. So by all means, let's talk about chips, but I want to talk about ships, not chips. And in that respect, there was a new initiative by the Trump administration. It was floated, I believe, in January, February. You can read in the Wall Street Journal. There were several articles about it. It got more serious in the spring. And now this initiative has come to fruition. And the idea, Danny, in a nutshell, is to put very heavy charges on the docking of ships, of Chinese ships in American ports. And we can talk about all the downstream results of such a policy. But I think the Chinese looked at that and said, this is an all-out American assault on the Chinese economy and on U.S.-China trade. And they, so in effect, they felt that was going nuclear.
And Gary, can you throw that full screen up that we had with the call out on that very topic? As a matter of fact, that was one of the things I was going to ask you about. This is also in the New York Times here. It says the Trump administration broadened its trade war with China on Tuesday as it began imposing fees on Chinese ships docking at American ports. The long planned action, as you said, I guess this is long planned, is intended to counter China's dominance of commercial shipbuilding and help revitalize the United States' own shipbuilding industry, which has withered over the years. China's Ministry of Transportation threatened retaliation on Friday, saying it's planned to hit American vessels with fees when they dock. And I was checking the news just before we came on here, and indeed they have done that, except that they have accepted any American vessels that were purchased in China. So they're saying, hey, they do seem to be going after, I don't know if it's, you call it a tit for tat, but they sure are going punch counterpunch. How do you see it?
But yeah, Danny, see, here's what I think the mainstream media is missing on this point, is that if you look at the numbers of U.S.-China trade, and it, the volume is huge. We're talking of almost $600 billion a year. It's an enormous amount of trade going across the Pacific. okay, it's going across the Pacific in what kind of hulls? Not in American hulls. There's almost no American shipping companies. I mean, some of the ships may be owned by Panama or something like that, but a lot of it is going in Chinese hulls. But the point is, the United States has no shipping or really commercial shipbuilding to speak of. Now, we build naval vessels. We can talk about that. And there is a, you know, I worked for the Navy. There is a Navy angle on this. We can explore that if you want, because here's where kind of national security and economic and the trade war kind of overlap here. And we should consider that. But I think for China, this was, if not the nuclear button, it was a sort of tactical nuclear button in this trade war. And I believe, you know, looking at the timing, it makes a lot of sense that this is what set off the really very hard-edged Chinese response on the rare earths. And again, I admit this took me quite by surprise, partly because I thought other aspects of U.S.-China relations were going pretty well. And, I'm very disturbed at this new direction because I take it we'll go there, but this could have spiraling results into the realm of national security.
Okay, let's go down that path here, because there's something that I think is puzzling to me. As I understand, you correct me if I'm wrong on the numbers here, but China has like over a 200 times, not percent, but times advantage over the United States in shipbuilding capacity. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think it's more like 230 times.
Okay.
According to CSIS. Yeah.
Somewhere around 230 times more. So if you're going to take action today that's going to impose docking fees on Chinese in order to stimulate American shipbuilding, I mean, you're going to have to, this is a multi, you correct me wrong if I'm here too, since you know the ship stuff a lot, it's going to be like probably a more than decade, maybe multi-decade process to even expand our capacity if we put a lot of focus and energy on it today. But that's not going to alleviate whatever's going on with this docking. How are those things actually connected in reality?
Well, that's what I find so upsetting here, is it doesn't seem to be a lot of thinking in realistic terms. And while it may sound good, like let's give an injection, you know, let's give some adrenaline, say, to the U.S. shipbuilding industry through these measures. And, you know, perhaps that is warranted in some respect. I mean, after all, it's not quote fair that all this trade goes on in with Chinese ships and no American ships. I'll grant you there's something there, but as you noted, the disparity is such that it's really at this point almost worth saying, is it, you know, let's say we can move the needle from, let's say, 0%, which it, I think it is today, or less than 1%, certainly, on American hulls to 3% or 4%. Probably that's what it would probably take a decade to get to a number like 4 or 5%. Man. And then what? You know, what have we actually achieved? I mean, we may have put some Americans to work. We may have gotten the, you know, Philadelphia yard or some yards in Jersey or something working again. But the strategic benefit of that is very questionable, I would say. And moreover, you know, as somebody who focuses on the Navy and naval strategy, I would say that this is really not well thought out. I mean, to make the point, our nation, we are not great at this point at building surface ships. It's just a fact that we've had kind of mistake after mistake, and we are missing, you know, whole groups of ships like frigates, but we are very good with what I consider the coin of the realm in naval power, and that is submarines. So we should focus on submarines, maintain our focus, and not get sidetracked on what I consider to be secondary or probably even tertiary. And moreover, because the way that naval strategy is going, just like every other domain of national security, is going toward drones. And so if we focus on drones and submarines, we'll be just fine in the Asia Pacific, and our naval power will remain very formidable.
So here's where we are, though, and where do we go from here? Because, I mean, what you're talking about, there's two separate. There's commercial shipping, and then there's military, the Navy kind of shipbuilding issues, and those have very different strategies, I would suppose. But what's in place right now is on, it affects commercial shipping, our own commercial shipping for that matter. So here's where we are now. So we have an effective tariff rate of 157% on China. Trump acknowledged this morning that that's not sustainable. We have export controls on rare earths, which we need. And we have now these really expensive docking fees, which are going to come back almost like in reverse tariffs, if you will. It's certainly going to have an effect on our consumers. I mean, it can't help anything to it. How do we get out of this? It's not going to spiral things into a worse economic situation for us.
Yeah, well, for one, I do want to say, I think one of the reasons that a lot is seems to be going haywire here is I think there's a profound lack of China expertise at the top here. Probably, you know, I would say looking at when this administration got started, the foremost China expert by far at the top of this administration was Elon Musk. And I think we're really suffering right now because there's no, I can't think of really anyone in the top ranks of the administration who knows China well. So, So this is a major problem because you don't have to spend much time in China to realize that they are a trade juggernaut par excellence with the shipping and shipbuilding to accompany that. And the idea that you're going to chip away at this. Anyway, the simple answer to your question, Danny, how do we get around this is for the president and his advisors to recognize that if they pull back on this port fees, like, you know, let's say the port fees were going to increase, you know, 1,000%. So walk that back to something like 100 or 200%, where, you know, you are throwing American shipbuilders a bone, fine. Honestly, the people who probably make money off it are the South Koreans and the Japanese. But in any case, we're trying to cooperate with Japan, with South Korea to get some shipbuilders, give them some relief and some help. But anyway, I'm just saying we can compromise a bit. Certainly we should compromise on the port fees because, as I said, there is no direct tie really to naval strategy as it's developing. And then the China, I think, would I predict they would walk back this very draconian rare earths moves because I think they probably even realize that they are really scaring a lot of businessmen with this talk, including their own. But in many other countries, I'll just give an example of where China may have dropped a big rock on its own foot here. In the last month or 2 months, China's relationship with South Korea has really been improving in a positive way. That's good for the United States, even, frankly, I would say. And there are market improvements. For example, South Korea was pushing through kind of like visa-free travel with China. And these countries are very close. So, I mean, that really could radically transform the relationship. So this is all going very well. But now, all of a sudden, this is the South Koreans are getting caught up in the U.S.-China trade war. And this means a lot of turbulence ahead, a lot of headaches, you know, so even for China trying to do business and improve its relations with South Korea, which I think is a major goal of Beijing.
Well, I want to shift gears here because bottom line is there's no easy answers for the administration, and I don't know if they're going to do that. And he still has this issue of this 157% tariff rate that, I mean, he can't just leave that there. He knows it's unsustainable. I don't know that anybody knows, probably even within the administration, but we'll leave that for the moment because that's something that's still going to be unfolded. Concurrent with all of that is the national security realm. Now, you have just published something at our parent defense priorities, Target Taiwan, prospects for a Chinese invasion. Actually, that's part of a larger series you just posted here. If you could put that that link up to the first one there, and we'll throw this in the description section for anybody who wants to find it, or they can just Google it, Defense Priorities, Target Taiwan. And there's four separate subcomponents of that, which maybe we'll have you back on to talk about the rest of them later. But I do want to look on that first one there about the challenges for Chinese invasion if they decided to invade Taiwan, because that's one of the biggest friction points, potentially even more than the economic stuff between the United States and China, going especially back into the Biden administration, where three or four times he said, yeah, we will fight China over Taiwan, even though he tried to walk it back. He kept on saying it, and this administration has been cooler on that, but not cold. And so it's still an open question whether we would or whether we wouldn't. One of the things I think you looked at here, and you can actually set this up here, that if anyone's considering that, we need to understand what the cost would be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think I would say that, Danny, you know, the real purpose of all of these studies, and there are five of them actually altogether, one is yet to drop, but I see you've focused on the first one.
Yeah.
Great. But if I were to give a title that kind of like encapsulates the entire series, you know, what are you trying to say, Goldstein? I am saying that the costs of this war, the risks of this war that we can envision are you know, just stunningly bad for the United States and for China, but you know, across the board, of course, for Taiwan, which probably would be destroyed even much worse than Ukraine has been destroyed. So, you know, what we're looking at here is something so devastating. I call it the most dangerous spot in the world, although I don't like what's going on in U.S.-Russian relations either today. Yeah. But to me, this is, you know, extraordinarily dangerous. The two superpowers, and I do call China a superpower in a way that I think Russia and maybe arguably the Soviet Union was never a superpower, right? China has this incredible economic heft and economic strength and national security strength are tied. So if China wants to build up a force of, you know, 5,000 or 10,000 nuclear weapons, they can do this in over the next decade, and they might. You know, I think they're scratching their head and thinking it over. You know, I do discuss in detail, not in this first of the series, but in the second of the series, I discuss the nuclear risks. That's, yes, in that second paper, I have a long section detailing how, you know, there is a rapid nuclear buildup going on in China, and they're responding to what they consider, you know, a huge threat from the United States. But the first, yeah, okay, there's the second of the series. So the first paper, which you were looking at before, that one looks at what would happen if China attacked Taiwan and there was no American intervention. You know, to summarize, I think it would be very bloody and very costly, but ultimately China would, I think, prevail reasonably quickly, probably within 2 months over the island. But the second paper then looks at what would happen if the U.S. intervened directly. And I know, you know, since we're Americans, we may focus on that second paper because we want to know, you know, well, how many Americans would die in this? And I'm telling you, my assessment is the cost would be enormous.
I actually want to ask a few specific questions about that, really, which would be in a case for either scenarios one or two, with or without U.S. Some of the points that you bring up here, which I don't think is really understood to a lot of depth for people outside of Taiwan or Chinese experts. And that is, you said geography matters and geography on the land and on the sea, because these wars would take place on all three domains. And one of the interesting things you point out is that on the land, unlike, say, in the Russia-Ukraine war, which includes quite a lot of armored vehicles to include drones and everything else, but a lot of armor is involved here. But you said this one would be much more a infantry-centric fight. Why do you say that?
Yeah, well, and here my analysis departs from a lot of others. I think Stimson just had a study which focused a lot on the challenges that China would have in getting, you know, enough tanks onto the island. And they talk a lot about Taiwanese geography, but my interpretation of the battle space is very different. And if you look at the topography of Taiwan, you'll see that it has enormous mountains. And about two-thirds of the island are just these enormous mountains, which clearly are not, you know, that is not, I don't have to tell you, Danny, you're the former armored officer, so you know well, but tanks are not, you know, that is not amenable to tank warfare. So the actual area in Taiwan where tanks could be used is relatively small. It's kind of a strip about 100 miles long and 30 miles wide, you know, and that's being kind of generous. So And it's cut by these deep rivers that have all kinds of bridges, which probably would be dropped pretty quickly in a war by both sides, frankly. But the point is, and most of that area, that sort of Western plain, if you will, which is not very large, it's mostly urban terrain. Taiwan's one of the most urbanized areas in the world. So, you know, the bottom line is, I don't think that armor is key to the campaign. I don't think China sees it that way. And that changes the whole approach to the landing. And that's where I think a lot of analysts
right.
are wrong.
It's and not that's where about, I wanted to go, because you cover, or at least pay attention to, the Russia-Ukraine war almost as much as I do. And I think that's really important, why I was interested in having you on this topic here, because you were looking at both sides. And because you speak and read both Chinese and Russian, you're able to look at what they say on each of these sides. And what I think we have seen from February 2022 up to the current time is that both the Russians and the Ukrainians have recognized that large armored formations are just no longer feasible because of the drone situation, whether that's bomber drones, or certainly the FPV drones, and the fiber optic drones, et cetera, these big Baba Yagas, et cetera. You still have to have them. They're important. But now then they're much, much less important, because if you mass them, we've seen them everywhere, Russian or Ukrainian, they're going to die in large numbers. So it seems to me that perhaps, and this is more of a question than a statement, that the Chinese may be recognizing that and say, why even worry about going over there with a lot of armor that you can't really use anyway, because drones are going to be an ever-present. So if you go in primarily on the ground with infantry and you can get them there in any number of ways, that's a lot less of a challenge than trying to get a bunch of armor over there, which may not do any good anyway. How do you see it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There are a lot of benefits to going with a infantry-centric focus. And I mean, the most obvious benefit is getting them ashore. I mean, it's a lot easier to pile a bunch of guys into a rubber boat and send them in where they can go into the shallows, and they can go in these very high speed vessels. By the way, that's the doctrine I believe our amphibious forces have gone into. Smaller, they're more dispersed, where somebody who's sitting there with a javelin or something has to think, is it really, you know, is a little rubber boat with six guys worth this javelins? But and then there are 500 or 1,000 of these little rubber boats coming at you, yeah. which are in turn set in the water by, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 fishing boats. I think a fishing boat is pretty well equipped to do that kind of thing. So, I mean, there are a lot of advantages just for getting them ashore. But then once they're ashore, look, if you're using basically light infantry, guess what? You don't need all that gasoline. And you know, well, you know, I'm talking to an armored officer, but
I do indeed.
You know, how many gallons, you know, does a, you know, force of, you know, a brigade of tanks use, or a company in, you know, one day of intensive combat? I mean, it's immense amounts of
yeah,
fuel.
It's enormous.
Yeah. Huge. And I mean, people often talk about D-Day in this context, and please remember, yes, we did bring tanks ashore, and yes, that, you know, American tanks were and British quite useful on the North German plain, you know, coming across France and into Germany. But that was a very different battle space than the one that, you know, that in the Taiwan circumstance, they're literally just pushing, you know, 20 miles inland. That's it. You know, it just doesn't have Taiwan is completely lacking in strategic depth. So yes, I think China has been watching Ukraine continuously. And boy, you know, I watch Chinese military news pretty much on a daily basis. I could tell you they are working very hard on all aspects of infantry combat, in particular urban combat.
And what about the sustainability of it? Actually, you know, before that, let's get to the Taiwanese side of that equation, because many people have said that they have some version of a porcupine theory, where they might make it so costly for China to come over that they would be deterred from doing so eventually. But then I've seen also other analysis that says, yeah, that may be in theory what they want to do, but the quality of the Taiwanese soldiers, they're not highly motivated. They have a hard time getting enough people even to show up for duty, et cetera, that many of them don't even think that there actually would be. And so the question is, how effective would the defending infantry force be in defending should China launch a concerted attack?
Yeah, there are a lot of questions here. Now look, if you study Taiwan's defense over a period of decades, you'll see for one, they haven't worried about it too much. You know, that comes for a variety of reasons. But if, you know, I think the 20-year average is something, you know, maybe slightly over 1% of GDP. So, first of all, they're not spending very much. And what are they spending that money on? Frequently, they've spent it on, you know, importing fighter aircraft from the United States. I will tell you, I think many strategists have come to the conclusion that those fighter aircraft are going to be absolutely useless because those runways will all be destroyed. So now the Taiwanese Navy has also gotten, you know, considerable investment, and they have some frigates and even are now building a submarine, I guess, which has some problems, teething problems. But again, China—it's well within China's capability that both the Taiwan Air Force and the Taiwan Navy would just literally be destroyed for the Navy. It would be destroyed in port. You know, literally, the ships would be sunk at the pier, most likely. Okay, well, what about the ground forces? As you imply, that's a pretty important group if you're facing an invasion. And indeed, there has been a kind of refocusing where I think many analysts are saying, "Well, boy." The Taiwanese would be wise to really stop pumping up their Navy and Air Force, which have real problems just getting into the fight, and put it all in on the ground forces. So they've been neglected, like I said, for decades. They've always been the kind of poor cousin poor sibling, let's say, in the group of the Taiwan Armed Forces. They don't even fill the roles of their active force, which are under 100,000. So, I mean, if we compare the active forces, reserves are something different, and reserves are said to be neglected in Taiwan too. But if you compare the active force, you know, we're talking about over a million Chinese active ground forces against less than 100,000. So the odds, you know, when we're talking about professional soldiers, are pretty steep. Now, look, I'll give you that reserve forces can play a role here, but I think even in simulations, they're rated at, you know, even less than half the combat power of the professionals. And I think Taiwan's reserves are in deep trouble, from what I understand. Now, look, reforms are recommended, and I join that group of, you know, people saying, well, Taiwan probably should focus on its reserves. But I think they're in very, very deep trouble. And you can't, as you know very well, Danny, you can't just wish your way out of this and say, oh, we'll change this regulation on reserve training and suddenly, you know, Taiwan will be fine. No, it really, as colleagues and I have been saying for over a decade, is really what Taiwan needs is probably just to dig, because they're facing a whole lot of firepower coming at them, which.
Right. And, you know, and by the way, just we've had Colonel Doug McGregor been on our show a number of times, and he's written a couple of different books specifically on the topic. And he says emphatically that if you wanted to transform your ground forces, you better have a full decade, because that's what it's going to take to turn it really into something good. And that's a decade of concerted year after year focus, effort, training, and funding and logistic support and all that. And I haven't seen that so far.
He's exactly right. Of course, McGregor is fantastic, but it's also, again, I'll double underline the point that it's always the Air Force and Navy in Taiwan that have always gotten, you know, the most money and the best, the best people and so forth. So it's, you know, transforming that on it to its head with this porcupine strategy, let's say it's easier said than done.
Right. Yeah. There's no question about that. When you get in terms of who wins and who prevails in modern combat, really in any combat, I mean, you can go back centuries, really. One of the real driving factors, aside from training and organization, your forces, logistics, those things that are indispensable, they're crucially important. But there's another factor, and I think that is the motivation and the morale of the two sides here. And I think that there's a misapprehension in the Western view, certainly in the United States, that I wonder if you could talk to, in that, and you mentioned this in some of your pieces here, the focus and the importance that the Chinese face on reunification with Taiwan. I think you used a term, you said that it is a core issue for the Chinese, meaning that they're not going to be easily dissuaded. And if we send some more arms and ammunition and weapons and some additional capabilities, that's not going to make China go, all right, well, it'd be just too much, whatever. How important is it to the Chinese to have eventual reunification? And if it comes to fighting, will they just like say, we will go all in no matter what it takes, or can they be dissuaded by cost?
Well, I'm going to say very clearly here, and again, I'm a bit of a radical in the China field, you know, I think there are many analysts who think, you know, well, if we make the cost too great, then China will stand down, if you will. But I don't see any evidence of that. Quite the contrary, you know, to me, all the evidence points the other way, and that this is a very, very deep obsession, you know, that is in the DNA of the Communist Party of China, but also, you know, within the leadership, that they consider this to be, you know, probably the most important issue, certainly in the top one or two or three issues for, you know, for how they consider, you know, their whole identity. And this is why I often point out, because comparisons are made all the time with the Ukraine war, and some of these comparisons are appropriate, but most are not, frankly. I mean, just keep in mind that Taiwan is about almost 20 times smaller than Ukraine, which, you know.
that's important.
That says a lot right there.
It does.
Right.
And they don't have, a whole bunch of friendly nations on their border that can just drive stuff in and out here. That's kind of important, too.
But getting back to your morale point, which I do think is essential. Look, you and I completely agree that is much more important than any weapons technology, or may even be more important than geography. Even that is the morale. What is the motivation of your fighting soldiers, airmen, and sailors? And to me, what I've seen is that when we say this is a core interest of China, what do we mean? I mean, this is literally integrated into all aspects of national life in China, but also of military life there. And so from day one of a soldier joining up in the PLA, he is told his mission, his central mission is to protect and unify the country. So this is every, you know, Chinese officer knows this and soldier and so forth. Now, compare that to Ukraine. Even the Russian soldiers going in initially, they themselves were confused about what they were doing. And, you know, I myself worked some with the Russian military, the Russian Navy and so forth. And if any of them, you know, back in 2010 or something, or 2005, could even imagine the idea of Russia and Ukraine going to war, it seemed like completely ridiculous. So put those two situations side by side. You know, in China, these people have been training for their entire lives and their entire mission set, their entire focus. Yeah, they do a few other things, you know, peace.
Great point.
They're almost 100% focused on this mission. Whereas in Russia, this was really shocking to the Russian military itself to be given this mission of getting, you know, heavily involved against Ukraine. And even to this day, you know, Russia, there are a lot of Russians who want no part of this. But I think that's just not at all the case in China. And you see that in the kind of focus and how China is developing all its strategies. I mean, the Chinese military, it all comes back to Taiwan ultimately. I mean, sure, they will engage in other things like the carrier program, for example, that's been a lot in the news. You don't need carriers to invade Taiwan. So, you know, you may scratch your head and say, what are they really doing with these? But ultimately, even the carrier program, everything is linked to Taiwan. And that kind of focus, that laser-like focus, I think will certainly carry the day. And that's why Americans would be very foolish to underestimate China's intent and even the morale of the PLA in a war.
Yeah, and let's pray to God we never find out, that this stays in the academic realm and that we just can talk about it and never have to observe it. Listen, in the amount of time we have left, you mentioned the Russia-Ukraine war. I do want to go to that because that's in the news today. And yesterday, where President Trump announced, first of all, yesterday, that he had a phone call with Vladimir Putin, and he's setting up a high-level delegation this coming week between Sergey Lavrov and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And then that's hopefully going to set up some conversations and a meeting, possibly in Budapest, Hungary, between Putin and Trump himself to bring this to an end. But Trump said in his Truth Social and some other commentary that, you know, I think we have a good chance to get this solved. It's unclear what substantively changed from Alaska, but that's what he said yesterday. Well, also yesterday, we had the vice president who had seemed a different view. He says no matter how energetic the diplomacy of the president of the United States could get people to the brink, ultimately it takes two sides willing to make a deal. And right now, for all our work, the Russians and Ukrainians are just not at the stage where they can make a deal. I think there's a fundamental mismatch of expectations where the Russians tend to think they're doing better on the battlefield than they actually are. So two parts there. First of all, what do you make of the seeming discontinuity between what the president of the U.S. said and what the vice president said about the readiness to make a deal?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm I'm trying to see all sides of this, you know, and I'm certainly listening to you and McGregor and Mearsheimer and experts like that, and trying to get battlefield reports. And, you know, I'm fully convinced, partly because I'm a regular listening to your show, that the, you know, that the, that Russia has all the military cards here, or almost all of them. And so it's, to me, you know, we are in a very delicate situation here, where things could get much, much worse. Look, I do think the Ukrainians and, you know, the Europeans and the West, we're not entirely, you know, that is, there are some cards to play. I do think that my observation is that Russia wants more. They want a clean victory, and they're not that far from that. So that is kind of tantalizing, I'm sure, for President Putin. But on the other hand, they know that to reach that kind of state where they're in a kind of the clean victory, where they get everything they want, a full loaf, if you will, would still be incredibly costly and also quite risky, let's face it. So, because a lot can go wrong between now and then. So even though things are going Russia's way now. So, and I fully agree with you, your analysis, that the trends, you know, clearly do favor that as we see them now.
But so let me specifically ask you, one of the things I've seen a lot of the pro-Western camp is saying that, listen, it was Trump's threat to bring Tomahawk cruise missiles into this and these huge economic sanctions that he had promised. That's what brought Putin to the table. That's why he's willing to talk now. So now here we can make a negotiated settlement. If that view is correct, then coming out of these meetings, there's going to have to be some pretty big gives on the Russian side. And as you just said, I don't see any compelling pressure on any of our side or in Trump's hands that would compel Russia to actually give in on its core requirements that they've had since really April of 2022. How do you view that? Did that bring Putin to the table? Or if not, why are they coming together to talk again after nothing happened in Alaska?
Well, I think on the Russian side, and you know, I spent a lot of time, just as I spent a lot of time in Chinese media, I am trying to watch a lot of Russian media as well. And I listened to your, you had Gil Doctorow on recently, and he said, you got to watch Russian TV. And the thing that's interesting, if you watch Russian TV, is that they talk about the war 24/7 with real experts. So you can learn a lot from that. whereas our side, you know, we talk about it for, you know, 5 minutes on the news, and it's, you know, that, so there's this like huge disparity in information and the quality of analysis. So there, I agree with Dr. O that we need to pay attention to what these people are saying. But yeah, I mean, look, the incentive on the Russian side absolutely is they want to talk and, you know, and keep talking. Now, you could fairly say that this is, you know, talk, right? They're not actually putting things on the table. But as you and Mearsheimer, McGregor and have all said, you know, over and over, that they don't really have to put things on the table. They're in a commanding position. Agree with that. So my estimate and my prediction here, you know, I don't expect any big breakthroughs, you know, so there, I guess I agree with Vice President Vance that probably, you know, the truth is this war isn't likely to end anytime soon. However, if I were counseling the White House about an approach, that is, how could you stop this war? If that's really the goal, like, let's stop this war, not tomorrow, but in a month. Could it be done? I think it's a very small probability, but there is, but how to do it? It would be to make some offers that Putin could not refuse, you know, and that's, you know, these are, you know, I call them, I say, we need to give the Russian side some carrots, and they need to be big fat carrots and juicy carrots. You know, now I know that's, you know, that kind of talk is anathema for European leaders and for Trump, but if you really want this war to stop, that's where we need to go. I have a few ideas on that, but just to float one or two, you know, there are these cities, Kherson for one, and I think Kherson was in the news in the last 48 hours for some Russian landings that were happening around Kherson, but also Kharkiv, for example. Now, I wouldn't even talk about Odessa, but let's talk about Kharkiv and Kherson for a minute. And I would just say, if the West, if the White House is serious about stopping the war, then put those on the table, say, President Putin, you can sacrifice 100,000 soldiers to get these two cities, or you can have them now. But if you're going to have them now, you've got to, you know, we're going to have to come to agreement now. You know, and yes, I do think peacekeepers, wherever they're from, you know, maybe from India, maybe from China, you know, we can talk about, or Brazil or something. You know, I don't think President Putin is going to accept peacekeepers from Western Europe. That's
right,
for sure, but almost for sure. But in any case, you have to put some carrots on the table, and these have to be hefty, because the Russians have the, as you've always said, they have the resources, and now they have also the momentum. And
okay, so let me throw in there that there's always a carrot stick. Well, in this case, I think you would need a baseball bat, not for the Russian side, but in that scenario, you might need it over for the Ukrainian side, because Volodymyr Zelensky, he ain't interested in any carrots for Russia. He's only interested in baseball bats and tomahawks to compel them in both the economic and the military realm here.
Yeah.
So is there any theoretical possibility that Trump could get not Putin to agree to that, but Zelensky?
Well, that is very difficult. But as you know, that's a political problem. I think I have to imagine that this has already happened, but, you know, I think Trump and company, I mean, it was done already in the spring, right, with the famous conversation where Trump and company read them the Riot Act. I mean, of course, Zelensky does have support in Europe, so he, you know, he's not entirely powerless here. And the Europeans, in my view, do, you know, they don't have a lot of resources, but they have some resources. So it's not, so yeah, this war probably, let's face it, will continue to go on. Will it go on for another 5 years? I sure hope not. Although, you know, think about the Northern War that Peter the Great fought for, I think, what, 20 or 21 years. So, I mean, that's, you know, we all know, in fact, Putin has explicitly said that is an example for him. And so I don't rule that out. And if we're wise, and if the Ukrainians are wise, and everybody is wise, we will look for a way out and hope that the people, you know, these catastrophic losses will come to a stop. I would say, last word I would say here, Danny, is that I think, okay, we can all sort of pray for that grand bargain that ends it. And I've put a few ideas on the table, but understanding they're not very realistic. But what is realistic? To me, we should be searching now before this, you know, possible Budapest summit, which I welcome. I think, you know, I do think talking is always better than fighting, certainly between the U.S. and Russia, when we're both nuclear armed to the, you know, completely and thoroughly, that what kind of interim solution? And here, like the grain deal, which happened, you know, fairly early in the war, you know, that's a pretty good example. One idea that I'm kind of promoting is think about, I think the North Koreans have played a role in this war, and I think they may play a future role in this war, but sort of maybe this would be a good short-term goal for the White House. Like, let's get the North Koreans out of there. You know, that's disturbing all across the board, and it has given Russia a lot of combat help. But how could we reach a deal possibly involving, you know, South Korea that kind of brought the North Koreans home, let's say, and as an interim kind of deal? And I have more ideas on that, but to me, that's where what we probably need to look for in the short term. We have to start to build some trust. There's no trust at all among the many parties now, and it's hard to very, very hard to reach an agreement, even, you know, any kind of agreement, if there's no trust.
Yeah, and I don't see any prospect of that, especially from the Ukraine side. They don't trust anything on the Russian side, and I can't even imagine them agreeing to that. So I hope it does too. That's why I've just been kind of scratching my head. I don't know where there is room for any kind of a breakthrough to happen, either in next week's talks, today's talks, because we're still waiting on a press conference even right now of President Trump and Zelensky. I mean, in light of his conversation yesterday with Putin, and so it's everybody's going to be real interested. We certainly are about what he's going to say next. But
yeah, well, as you've always said,
I just don't see it.
Yeah, I mean, you've always said, and Mearsheimer and everybody, that it's, I mean, what happens on the battlefield will determine what is possible. So that I think is absolutely clear. The only question in my mind is, have the leaders in Brussels or in Kiev, are they attuned to the realities of the battlefield? And unfortunately, and maybe that's true for the White House too, are they realizing just how difficult the situation is? I mean, by my count, the Russians have surrounded the Ukrainians in five different places, and it's not clear whether the front will break at the top of the bottom, but it is cracking as I think we're observing.
Let me ask you one final question on the way out, because you mentioned early on about the importance of morale and motivation and what drives you, et cetera. And you talked about how the Chinese, that's all they've been thinking about for decades about here. And when the Russians started, they couldn't even imagine it just, you know, a decade before. That's not even, wasn't even on their mentality. But if it wasn't on there at the beginning, it certainly seems to be there now. And since you are really tuned to Russian television and popular opinions, et cetera, it seems to me that they are now fully in a position to where I don't see, there's no way in hell that they would not go through until they have a victory, whether it's on the diplomatic front or on the military front, but it has to be on their terms or they will consider it a failure. How do you see it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question now, Danny, and understanding, you know, the shape of morale on both sides of the line. I mean, my sense is that on the Ukraine side, you know, there's immense fatigue and sadness at the huge losses that have occurred. But I do think some of that is also true on the Russian side. And I think that partly explains why, you know, because you and I and others for many years have been kind of wondering why, you know, it seems like the front is very weak, that Russia could massively exploit some of these breakthroughs. But I think one reason that Putin has adopted this very much go slow, nibbling kind of approach to the war is very much that he is not ready to take, you know, the enormous casualties that would result from making, you know, kind of giant, as we like to say, big arrow thrusts into the rear. Yeah. That would just be incredibly risky and the losses might be very high. So he's kind of contented himself with this approach that is kind of where casualties are much reduced. But I want to contrast that with the Chinese case. I do think if it came to war over Taiwan, that China would go into it accepting that they may suffer a million casualties and they would be quite comfortable with that. That's a commentary on where they're at, but mentally they are prepared. They understand that the losses would be immense. And that's why, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, China would never do this because the cost would be huge. And I say, yeah, the cost would be huge.
And they may be.
Yeah, well, but whereas I don't think the Russians are at that point. You know, partly it's, you know, an issue of demographics. You know, Russia has even before the war was in a kind of demographic problem, and arguably China is too, but not to that.
China does have a few more people.
They do indeed.
You know what? So they can have a different viewpoint on that. No, well, listen, right. I really appreciate you bringing a lot of clarity on all these issues here. And again, we refer people back to this new series that you have, Polish Air Defense Priorities. It's going to be in the description field below. We'll have that put in there and you can just Google it and find it. We appreciate that. And we'll probably have you back to talk about some of those others in the future.
Wonderful, Danny. Yeah, I'd love to come back.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you guys. And by the way, like we said, we're going to be coming back this afternoon where Trump, Tomahawks, and meeting with Zelensky. Where is this all going? We're still waiting to find out what kind of commentary comes out of the White House today with Zelensky. All ears are going to be on that, and we will have it for you this afternoon at 3 or 4 p.m. We're going to be depending really on what happens with the announcement. So as soon as we do, keep an eye on the timer here, and we will let you know. We look forward to seeing you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.